All right. Hello, everybody, and happy Friday. Welcome to the end-of-week edition of American Hit Radio here on WHPC 90.3 FM.
I can dig it.
Whew, yeah, thank God it's Friday. Isn't that the truth? I'm always glad to be here. I'm especially glad to be here on Friday, though, that's for sure.
The happiest of happy hours.
I'm your host, Tom Ryan, with me, of course, my lovely wife, Heidi Morales Ryan, carrying my cold. So if Heidi does cough, we'll have to forgive her this week because she's got it worse than I do at the moment. But you're a trooper. You're here. I'm glad for that. We have to start a whole new series.
I took my Alka-Seltzer.
Yeah, good for you. We start a whole new series today, Heidi. Something brand new and different. We go, you know, it wasn't too long ago. We just finished up doing, I think it was 19 shows on Louis Armstrong.
Yes.
And we jump back to the contemporary era, sort of. We did the pre-British invasion. Now we're going to go back to the early part of our history again.
Okay.
Go back to around the jazz age is what we're going to be focusing on with today's show. Actually, the title of this series that we're beginning today is going to be Bix, Tram, and the Jazz Age. Excuse me, as in Bix Beiderbecke, uh-huh. Frankie Trambauer, and the Jazz Age.
Okay.
Whole new thing. Now, of course,
start taking my notes.
Well, I do expect this to be very interesting, and this should fill in some of the gaps that we had with the topics we've already covered. For example, we've already covered the birth of jazz. We've covered the development of jazz in New Orleans,
uh-huh.
how the roots of like the original jazz. Of course, we've covered Louis Armstrong in great depth. We've covered Jelly Roll Morton, which led us to basically cover an awful lot of ground. What we didn't really cover yet, though, is how it eventually began to cross barriers, race barriers. And that's pretty much what this show is going to be about. Now, that being said, from today's, this is a bit uncomfortable for me, actually, because like from today's perspective, it probably seems politically incorrect or maybe even racist to portray the history of early jazz in terms of black and white. I mean, obviously, you're thinking, well, that doesn't, you know, why would you want to do that? Because it just seems like it's the wrong thing to do. But the truth is that that is exactly how history unfolded. Segregation and Jim Crow saw to that. So like in any other presentation of jazz, where you would try to combine the two of them, would be pure fantasy or revisionist history. Because that's not the way that it went down. That's why this series, Bix, Tram, and the Golden Age, is going to focus pretty much exclusively on the white musicians who were responsible for some of the greatest innovations in jazz history and who helped develop the genre into something that eventually did unify the races. And there's no doubt that, of course, that most of their inspiration was coming ultimately from New Orleans jazz and the black people who had innovated jazz. But with society being as stratified as it was at the time, the fact simply remains that there were white influences that thought that they were actually doing something totally separate from what black jazz was about. For example, the very first jazz band to record, the original Dixieland Jazz Band, led by a man named Nick LaRocca, claimed till his death that jazz was 100% his creation. A white man came up, he recorded the first record, and he said that I recorded it and everybody else stole it from me.
Nice.
So this is where we're functioning from. And yet his band was immensely influential because they recorded Livery Stable Blues, which was the first huge selling jazz record, which did cross all sorts of barriers and as far as race and everything else. But it didn't really do much beyond that, especially as far as like helping the races to play together, because society just wasn't ready for that. So we're going to be focusing on what eventually became the biggest star of I'd say like the white pocket of jazz that was existing, and that is Bix Beiderbecke. Now, the thing about Bix is he's one of the most incredible enigmas that I could possibly try to cover. I mean, he only lived to be 28 years old, which obviously is incredibly short amount of time.
Yes.
And, you know, there's very little that's known about him, except, well, we'll cover what we do know right now. He was raised upper middle class in Davenport, Iowa. Right. On the banks of the Mississippi, kind of near Rock Island, Illinois. He was baptized Leon Bismarck Beiderbecke. That was his name. Bix for short, of course, on March 10th, 1903. But any attempt to really encapsulate his life with any type of detail, I mean, we're at a distinct disadvantage. I mean, his family themselves claimed that they never really understood him. what motivated him. His friends all claimed to have never really known him. There was a sort of glaze behind his eyes. He had bright, clear eyes, but they just never really knew what was going on inside of his head. Dead before 30 with very few photos, only 40-some-odd letters that have been found that he had written in his entire life, and maybe about 200-some-odd recordings that he played on, most often or very often as a session player only. So what do we really know about him, except for the fact that his love of jazz led him to basically live the jazz life during Prohibition, which means he became hugely dependent upon bootleg booze, which eventually controlled his life until it ultimately killed him. Well, we know this much for certain. Bix Beiderbecke was a third-generation American descended from Prussians who settled in the American Midwest in Iowa and made a small fortune as grocers, due mostly to the lucky fact that they had gotten a contract with the Union Army during the Civil War to supply the Union Army. As I said, he was baptized Bismarck, shortened to Bix, and as he grew up, his parents noticed quite soon that he was something of a prodigy. He would be able to reproduce songs on a piano by ear as a young child, almost instantly. So he showed a definite...
proclivity.
Exactly, for music. However, everything that was great about what he knew about music, he was the exact opposite in almost every other way that had anything to do with learning. He was an atrocious student. He reacted horribly to formal training, and he always had issues in school. He was a poor student, atrocious report cards, horrible attendance. He'd cut school all the time.
He wasn't interested.
He just had no interest in school whatsoever. He just hated formal training. What made the difference for him is one day, his older brother came home with this new contraption called a Victrola. And he brought a couple of records by the original Dixieland Jazz Band, who we had just been speaking of. And I'm going to read a little bit now from a book by Jean-Pierre Léon called The Definitive Biography of a Jazz Legend, Bix. These records resulted in Bix's first encounter with jazz, and the adolescent was immediately fascinated by the discovery. His head plunged into the horn of the machine. He played the two sides over and over for hours, indifferent to anything else.
Sound familiar?
Yeah, really. Like me. Leah, a neighbor, gave him an old dented cornet, and he spent weeks fiercely and relentlessly reproducing on the instrument notes that he had picked up, one by one, from listening to the record played at slow speed. At first, it was hard on the rest of us, remembered Bernie. His playing consisted of short, blasting notes until he got a mute. The mute was a godsend, and we were able to go on with our lives while the lad practiced. Every spare moment was spent in front of the phonograph, practicing, learning, and hearing what no one else heard. One day, he suddenly seemed to know what he was doing, and he took off from there. The notes had changed and were coming through sweetly and quietly. It was startling how quickly he learned. Well, that being said, he eventually joins a high school band, but because he had such a good ear and he was tinkering on the piano, he joined as a piano player in the high school band.
Oh.
And he eventually did soon move to trumpet. He'd go back and forth between the two instruments. He continued to immerse himself in the instrument, including some formal lessons, but it didn't last long because he didn't develop a knack for reading. That was the formal part of it. And he just didn't want to learn how to read music. So he wasn't good at it, didn't want to get good at it. And that was a problem for him because it was a requirement to read music if you wanted to join the musicians' union.
Oh, that's weird. He must have had a learning disability that prevented him.
In retrospect, I was thinking the same thing. Probably the case. But he continues to practice and he pushes himself to the limits of his creativity constantly. Combining moments of brilliance with these really embarrassing gaffes. I mean, there's a load of accounts of people back then who would watch him be playing and he'd do something totally brilliant and then he'd suddenly hit a whole series of really bad notes, you know, just flub it up. But, you know, learning, doing the best that he could and studying as best as he possibly could. And eventually a band called the New Orleans Rhythm Kings, or actually at this point, they were a band that was backing a singer named B. Palmer. B. Palmer had one of these racy shows where she would sing jazz songs and whatever else, and it was
songs
very
of drunken depravity.
Yeah, it was sort of scandalous, her style and her performance and such, and she was eventually asked to leave town. But the band that was playing with her included Emmett Hardy and Leon Rapolo. Now, Emmett Hardy, let's see if I can find some information about him here. This is another guy who was cut down early in life. Died really young, born in 1903, and he was dead by 1925. So he barely got to be 20, just barely 21 years old when he had died. Another New Orleans native, actually Gretna or Algiers, you know, moved in the suburbs.
Yeah, the West Bank.
Right. and he grew up surrounded by the jazz of the city. And he was so good on the trumpet that it was said in the year 1919 he got involved in a cutting contest with Louis Armstrong, who at that point was also very young. Mm-hmm. And they said that during a fierce battle between the two in this cutting contest, he actually was able to beat Louis at this point. That's how respected Emmett Hardy was in his time. We know very little. He played with Papa Jack Lane, one of the most legendary old brass bands of New Orleans and all that stuff. And he eventually, you know, did start to back B. Palmer. Unfortunately, there's almost nothing that I can play by him because the only recordings that exist were apparently homemade cylinders that he had cut by himself for fun. But it wasn't, you know, not soon long afterward that he had developed tuberculosis and had died. But at this point, obviously, he's quite alive. Bix is seeing him playing in Davenport, and he is blowing his mind. Here's an account of what is of young Bix hanging out with these guys. Emmett Hardy and Leon Rapolo spent several more days on tour with B. Palmer, but by mid-March, they returned to Davenport to play with Carlisle Evans Orchestra at the Coliseum. They played 3 months with this band, and they had Bix as a devoted fan throughout their stay, his only limitation being the 75 cents that it would cost him to get in. Emmett Hardy left his friends many memories, obviously magnified by the fact that he died so young, but the lack of recordings, appreciation of his playing, and his possible influence on Bix relies only on a few contemporaries' accounts. However, he must have shown a true artistic originality. He clearly contrasted with the brilliant and vivid style of New Orleans musicians, and he seems to have been among the first jazz men to play solos. His mastery of his instrument was, at that time, far superior to Bix's, who in all likelihood benefited greatly from listening to Hardy during the 3 months he had spent in Iowa. Bix often tried to sit in with the band to the great irritation of them, who considered with consternation this leech-like, stubborn boy approaching his band, the young man still capable of the worst clumsiness in his playing. There's actually a quote here that says, "Here comes that Beiderbecke pest. Hide the horn." So he obviously had a lot to learn. But these guys eventually, as I said, went on to form the legendary jazz group, the New Orleans Rhythm Kings. And they would become very influential on Bix. And in fact, maybe this is a good time actually right now at this point to play a track by Bix just to give you a taste of where we're going with this. So here's a track by Bix's very first band called The Wolverines playing Copenhagen. Thank you. just to give you a taste of where we're going, play one track a little bit out of sequence, but that's called Copenhagen by the Wolverine Orchestra. That was recorded on May 6th, 1924 from the Bix Beiderbecke's second recording session of his entire life. We've got a little ways to get to the first, though. Just forgot to just give you something just to carry us through, so to speak.
Oh, good.
Hear where we're going.
A little taste.
Well, as I said, of course, now he's basically seeing the New Orleans Rhythm Kings, and he's really he's getting stimulated. He's getting totally blown away by this whole jazz thing. And unfortunately, his poor school grades were only getting worse at this point. And then an embarrassing thing happened. This was actually really kind of kept secret for quite a long time about his life. But there was an incident that involved something about Bix and something sort of a sexual innuendo thing with a neighborhood girl where they had claimed that he had asked her to lift her skirt or something.
Oops.
And the father was, called the police on him and everything else. And this basically caused a big problem. And in fact, this was just recently uncovered by people who were doing some research on him. They found police records about it. Like, oh, so it was time to get Bix out of town. And he was thoroughly embarrassed in front of his family, in front of everybody, that this could have even happened. And whether or not it even did is a matter of conjecture. It was accused. So the parents decided to enroll Bix in a private academy, what you basically did with kids who were bad in school.
That's right.
They were wealthy enough so they could do it. So he continued to play around Davenport in his group until the very end when in September of 1921, he went off to Lake Forest Academy in Moline, Illinois, to go to school there, private school, live-in school. What his parents didn't count on, though, was that Lake Forest Academy was 60 minutes outside of Chicago. All of a sudden, Bix has got access to a place that is actually pretty much the king of jazz. I'm sorry, basically the center of jazz world, as was at this boarding school. Well, anyway, despite his intense interest in music, he never really made any attempt to understand music theory or to learn to write music. His reading was negligible at best, and all this kind of flew in the face of his own ambition. He obviously wanted to be a good player, and he could play really well, but he was ignoring the structure and the discipline that was demanded of his craft. He just embraced the passion of the music, what his parents would call this Negro brothel music from New Orleans. And, they didn't get it. They didn't understand why he was loving it so much, but this is what he was immersing himself in. And it must have been weird, a Midwestern kid suddenly just latching onto this and dedicating his life to this.
It was the rock and roll of his generation, though, right?
Right. In fact, yeah, maybe even more so, because it was absolutely at a time in the Midwest where society was as divisive as it was, with the cultural lines between black and white being so strict. Bix is all about breaking down that barrier. He wants to basically learn to be like his black heroes. He just wants so much to be like that, and the people who know him and grow up with him don't get it. They're like, you must be crazy.
Right, you're supposed to be a banker.
Right. Or going into the family business.
Right.
Well, of the 44 letters that are known to have been written by him, about half of them date from this era when he's at school, because he's away from school and he's writing home to his parents.
Right.
And the whole reason he's writing home to his parents the whole time is to pretty much soft soap them with stories about how A-OK he was. And, everything's doing great and the school suits him just fine.
Meanwhile, he's sneaking off into Chicago to see jazz bands.
Exactly. The truth was that, he was still a self-conscious kid full of securities, and he had a huge proclivity to drink a ton of bathtub booze whenever he could. And this was all aided by the fact that he was obsessed with jazz, and he was now just an hour's drive from jazz's ground zero.
Wow.
In Chicago. So
he couldn't have asked for a better situation, really.
For him.
Yeah.
And he was able to hide it from his parents the whole time he was basically doing this. So he forms a band, and he starts to play dances at the academy, and he becomes popular for doing that. But Chicago constantly loomed. And by 1922, he was so wrapped up in playing with the best musicians that he could possibly hook up with that he became utterly indifferent to the Lake Forest Academy agenda.
Oops.
Wasn't even going to classes at all. Meanwhile, his playing style starts to reflect his persona, the person that he is.
Mm-hmm.
He has no inclination whatsoever to show off. He's sort of like the exact opposite of Louis Armstrong, who is always so strong and such a player that Louis almost unconsciously would take over the record because he was just that good. Bix was just laid back. He wanted to basically let the notes roll and come from inside of him. He was understated, but still very expressive. And his talent had grown so noticeably that now orchestras who had written arrangements were actually allowing Bix to sit in. around this time. He began to grow. His talent began to get significantly better. It was around, also around this time, in about 1922, that he discovered this place called the Friars Inn in Chicago. It was a basement club, of course, where jazz was played. The New Orleans Rhythm Kings were playing there on a regular basis, and Bix just basically holes up there and wants to see pretty much every single show that he possibly can when he's there. Let's see. I'm trying to see if I can find some notes on that place. I thought I had my notes right here. Okay, well, be that as it may. He's watching the New Orleans Rhythm Kings, and this place, actually, it inspires an entire generation of jazz enthusiasts. What's going on in this place? Well, the New Orleans, Hoagie Carmichael, the guy who wrote Stardust and Georgia on My Mind, is doing the same thing as Bix. He's going there every single day and watching them. And he obviously becomes very close to Bix because they're sitting there watching this new type of music being developed and watching the white bands and occasionally when they can, catching the black bands whenever that's possible. Guys like King Oliver, who is the hero of all of them.
Right.
That's how early this is. So King Oliver is the king to all of them. Louis Armstrong isn't even in Chicago yet. Keep this in mind. They don't even know who he is yet. Now, these are white guys, but like I said, they openly emulate their black heroes, people like King Oliver. And Bix was so obsessed that he virtually hung out every single night, and ultimately his obsession got him expelled from school.
Well, eventually his parents were going to get a report card, I should imagine.
They basically got the letter saying that your son's kicked out. I mean,
stop sending money.
Haven't seen him for a while, so, you know, he's kicked out. And in fact, don't even have him come back and take his tests, because now that we've heard all the stories about what he's been doing and the way he's been drinking booze onto the campus and everything else, we don't want him to come back, so forget it. So he's too ashamed to return home to his parents for a while, so instead what he does is he just goes to Chicago hoping to find work as a musician. Now, this is the summer of 1922, and what happens in the summer of 1922? Louis Armstrong arrives in Chicago.
Oh, wow.
This is exactly when King Oliver called
Big
Louis
time.
Up.
Yes.
And this is what we were covering when we covered Louis Armstrong. We all know how that affected everything.
Yes.
So now, here's Louis totally flooring Chicago, changing the entire world, while Bix has his own band together, and he's suddenly pulled out of Chicago because he gets to go on tour with his band. He's now touring vacation spots in upstate New York, and eventually
doing the Catskills.
Right, exactly, the Catskills, and eventually comes back to to New York City, and it's there where he hears Nick LaRocca's and the original Dixieland Jazz Band live for the very first time. He's hearing their repertoire. And again, he's just thinking, like, this is incredible. But between the New Orleans Rhythm Kings and the original Dixieland Jazz Band, they're kind of proving that there's a white interest in this music that is coming out of New Orleans. So he eventually finds himself, you know, back in Davenport, where his father makes one last and ultimately futile attempt to recruit him into the family business, which was actually of selling coal and wood. And here's pretty much where this goes right now. This is what Bix is between. In January of 1923, Bix was authorized by his father to take a few more short breaks in Chicago. He rehearsed with Del Skinner's quintet, but his style was too original and he didn't get the job. Naturally, he went back to the Friars Inn, where he ran into Hoagie Carmichael, George Johnson, Vic Moore, all permanent fixtures of the place. A late-night visit to the Lincoln Gardens allowed these young white jazz men to meet the budding genius on second cornet in King Oliver's band, Louis Armstrong, who was 21 at the time, while Bix was almost 20. We took 2 quarts of bathtub gin, a pack of muggles, which is to say marijuana, and headed for the black and tan joint where King Oliver's band was playing, wrote Hoagie. As I sat down to light my first muggle, Bix gave the sign to a big black fellow playing second trumpet for Oliver, and he slashed into bugle call rag. I dropped my cigarette and gulped my drink. Bix was on his feet, his eyes popping. For taking the first chorus was the second trumpet, Louis Armstrong. Louis was taking it fast. Why, I moaned, why isn't everybody in the world here to hear this? I meant it. Every note Louis hit was perfection. So, it was at around this exact same time that Bix eventually meets up with a guy named Frankie Trambauer. Now, we'll get more involved with Frankie in our next show when we talk about some of his past, but I should at least mention that they meet at this time, and Trambauer had come to town as one of 3 saxophone players playing in this group called the Benson Orchestra. Mm-hmm. Now, he's just one of 3 guys. This is a huge orchestra that's playing. And at this point, there's still no recording opportunities had developed for Bix. But by the summer of 1923, Bix was asked to join a band on a riverboat steamer. So he jumped at the chance, and he found himself playing on the riverboat with a 14-year-old boy on clarinet by the name of Benny Goodman.
Wow.
Around this time, if you can imagine that, on a riverboat. And in September, Bix finally gets his union card. How? His mother intervenes for him. She knew the people and said, just don't give him the written part of the test. So they didn't, and he miraculously got his union card. So now at the height of Prohibition, Bix set out to get work, and he did. An out-of-the-way place called the Stockton Club needed a band, so he cobbled a band together. None of the members could read in the group, which was great for Bix because it made his life a lot easier. So what he did was he wrote arrangements by getting his other players to imitate what he would play on his horn. Bix had such a good ear that he would create each part by ear on his horn, and the different players would mimic it, learn it, and they'd know what to play as a group. They took their name from a Jelly Roll Morton song, just to say Wolverine. So It became the Wolverine Orchestra, was thus born. That simple. Their repertoire at first was based almost exclusively on original Dixieland jazz band material, but with a contemporary touch, as the original Dixieland jazz band was already considered old-fashioned by 1923. Now, to get into that, I think what we ought to do is hear a track at first by the New Orleans Rhythm Kings, which is the band that had influenced Bix so strongly. So let's hear that now, a song called Tiger Rag by the New Orleans Rhythm Kings. There you have it. That's the New Orleans Rhythm Kings, actually. That is not Bix Beiderbecke's band. That's a band featuring Leon Rapolo and Emmett Hardy, who we had mentioned. Actually, not Emmett Hardy. Excuse me. He was playing with them, but he had never been recorded. He was a member for a short while in that group. But these recordings were made after he had already passed. But this is the group that had inspired him so much. Now, as I had said, though, after Bix had seen the original Dixieland jazz band, they had become huge. They were incredibly famous because of the Livery Stable Blues, if I'm saying it correctly. And now Bix had seen them in New York City, so he had started to incorporate some of their repertoire into his music. And his very first recording session is him playing a song that was written by Larry Shields and Nick LaRocca, who were the two main members of the original Dixieland jazz band. For comparison now, because this is really the only way to figure out why Bix is so influential, I think, is to hear how jazz was developing. I think we should hear the original version by the original Dixieland jazz band as they recorded it, and then we can compare it to see why, by the time, here it is just 4 years later, 4 years, 1924, when Bix records his version of this song. And at this point, because
you think he brought something to the table?
Well, what ends up happening is, I mean, he makes the ODJB sound old-fashioned already. They sound like they are doing, you talk about tradition jazz or trad jazz. Well, he's kind of, already by 1924, imagine that. You know, it's hard to imagine today that was the case. But, well, here's the original first, and we'll see if we can get an ear for this. Here's the original Dixieland Jazz Band with their version of a song called Fidgety Feet. Now, just to make sure that you are following me in this, I want to make very clear that was not Big Spiderback.
That's the before.
Exactly. That's what I'm playing as the before track. That's the original Dixieland Jazz Band with Nick LaRocca as the lead, who had written the song, playing the song. Notice the stiff rhythm. That's that very stiff, very kind of
staccato.
Like there's like got a pull up their butt or something. There's, you know, the playing is very ensemble, not much solo. You know, except for like the occasional, they just stop and they'd be like, you know, that'd be about it.
Yeah.
It's
very arranged.
Yeah, very much arranged around the ensemble playing all at the same time. And no real sense of dynamics or feel. You don't feel like there's anything necessarily that's coming from inside of the player. They're playing outside of the song.
Right, there's no soul in it.
Now, this is what they're saying just 4 years later. Now, here's Bix coming on, bringing his own personality to it and his own sense of influence, what he thinks he's picking up from watching his black heroes and the white guys that he's worshiping too, because he loves these guys. But he just can't help but be himself because Bix is bringing his own thing to it. And at his very first recording session, he records that exact same track. So here is the very first time Bix Spiderback ever set foot in a recording studio, recording that exact same song called Fidgety Feet. Thank you. that is the Wolverines with Bix Beiderbecke on trumpet, and obviously had very much rewritten the arrangement of the song, added totally different new parts. Took a lot. First thing, he takes out the redundancy, which is, I noticed right off the bat. The other thing that you notice that he does is that he takes it at a slightly slower, bouncier tempo, more of a swing beat. Actually, kind of applies that triplet feel to give it like a swing feel, which was sophisticated, smart thing to do, you know, and more solo playing. So on a lot of different cylinders, you can tell that Bix is getting it.
He's firing.
And once you hear that version of Wolverine Blues, it suddenly makes the other one just sound old school. And this is what began to happen to the original Dixieland jazz band. They began to sound like what we'd eventually would call Dixieland.
Right.
Just to say stayed, stuck, you know, in the past and all of that. What we should also look at now, too, is comparing this to what was actually happening at this exact same time. Around 1924, when Bix recorded that track, the national attention at this time was focused actually on New York City, where a guy by the name of Paul Whiteman and his orchestra was debuting a new composition called Rhapsody in Blue, written by George Gershwin. Whiteman is one of the most aptly named people in the history of jazz because he pretty much represents like the white perspective of what popular music and jazz was about in the jazz age. He is a controversial figure because he actually went under the name the King of Jazz, which was ludicrous at the time. You could have called him maybe the King of the Jazz Age because he was so popular. I mean, everybody, he sold more records than anybody. I mean, what he was recording pop, so he was a dance band, really, that would record pop hits. And people would hear the pop hits. And this is what made him so famous. If you saw a picture of Paul Whiteman, he looks exactly like Oliver Hardy. Like Laurel and Hardy.
Yes.
He's this pudgy, round-faced guy with the little mustache, right? That just like everything, but you don't see the humor in his face, but he's just got that look. And his huge popularity from his dance numbers that he had recorded is what eventually caused his agents to dub him the King of Jazz because jazz was getting popular. So Whiteman actually just jumped on the bandwagon, so to speak. And what he was doing as far as jazz, well, it was maybe jazz only insofar as what he was trying to emulate, but it was hardly jazz. I mean, even from his own perspective, I mean, this is in his own words, more or less, this is a quote. Mr. Whiteman intends to point out the tremendous strides which have been made in popular music from the day of the discordant jazz to the really melodious music of today, which, for no good reason, is still called jazz.
Yeah.
He felt like he was adding sophistication to jazz by taking out all the rough edges and whitening it up. Well, let's play a track by Paul Whiteman to set the stage for the time of what music was like at this time. Here's one of his biggest hits. It's a song called Whispering.
Thank you.
as my engineer Earl just said, there's some granny music for you.
Yeah.
That's what it sounds like, right? I mean, obviously, could hardly be called jazz, that track. And yet, Whiteman basically, you know, ever the opportunist.
Well, he called it appropriately. He says that he didn't understand why they still called it jazz.
Right. Because it, by necessity, isn't. However, his orchestra was hugely talented, and he's going to play a very important role in our story, in this part of our series, because Bix eventually joins Whiteman's band.
Oh, boy.
For a long time. So a lot of Bix's recordings are going to be with that man at the baton. So we'll have to keep that in mind as we go forward. At this point, though, as I said, while Bix is in the studio with his first track, Whiteman is actually doing something remarkable, recording something which is a landmark recording, still one of the most landmark recordings of all time, when he's recording George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, mm-hmm. played live at Aeolian Hall. That's a huge, big deal as far as uniting jazz with classical music. But while that's happening, the Wolverines, still in their first recording session, there's one of the tracks I want to play from that session. With Bix Beiderbecke at his first recording session. This song is called Jazz Me Blues. What I want you to listen to here, this has got the very first recorded solo by Bix. And that's what you're going to hear here on this track. Many critics state that this sort of betrays his obsession with the clarinet because his style is so fluid and loose. People like Larry Shields of the original Dixieland Jazz Band and Leon Rapolo of the New Orleans Rhythm Kings obviously were huge influences on him. And they say he had a bit of an obsession with the clarinet. So maybe the reason Bix was so understated on the trumpet was because he loved the looseness and the feel that you could get from a clarinet. So he plays with this gentle grace that is very rare for a horn player. So see if you can find that right with your own ear on this track by the Wolverines. It's called Jazz Me Blues. Jazz Me Blues, as you can tell. That's Bix Beiderbecke's first recorded solo there with his group called the Wolverines, recorded back on February 18, 1924. Now, the record was released on Gennett Records. This is that same place that Louis Armstrong was recording with King Oliver in the early days, and where he actually recorded his first sides with the Hot Five. But as Bix's record was being released on Gennett. It was distribution was very limited, so it only sold a few thousand copies. But it made some influence. It made enough of an influence that there was interest in another one. But meanwhile, the band tried to capitalize on the energy that was generated by this first recording session. And don't think it was easy either to sound good in a recording studio in those days, because there were big bands that were just giving up entirely, that would try to record and they would come up with nothing but garbage, and there was nothing that was usable from the session. For some reason, Bix was good at it. He just was able to record himself
natural.
Well. For a first session, that was an amazing feat to come out sounding like that. Very rare for the time. So they want to capitalize on this, but they were thwarted because they had an obligation to play at this club called Doyle's Dance Academy, and it was a sleepy gig, and it really the people there weren't getting what they were about, and they didn't want the gig.
They were so square.
So what happened was, I'll just read it again. The band was told that they had to play until the end of their commitment, and in order to prevent any possible escape, their instruments were locked into the ballroom every night after closing. So on the night of March 31st, a large tuba tied to a rope was lowered silently from the third floor window down into a convertible parked on the pavement. It was followed by a set of drums, a saxophone, and a banjo. Cornet and clarinet landed together, leaving behind a solitary piano in the large and deserted ballroom. Dick Voynow, who was actually part of the band, who had managed to get locked in after the show, slid down the rope and joined the group on the street. From there, the Wolverines left without a trombone in search of a new job. Now, Hoagie Carmichael, Bix's friend from the Friars Club, saves the day by arranging for a gig at Indiana University in April of 1924. Now, we should cover a little bit about Hoagie's past as well right here as well. Here's some of his biography. Hoagie was born in Bloomington, Indiana on November 22, 1899. His mother, like Bix's, was a piano player. She used to play ragtime songs in movie theaters. Hoagie would also share with his younger friend from Davenport a much stronger aptitude for rebellion than studies. He moved with his family to Indianapolis in 1916, where he spent three difficult years. Uprooted, cut off from his landmarks, he found a job running a cement mixer, and then, a terrifying experience for a born artist, he worked in a slaughterhouse.
Ew.
Before the tragedy of his sister's death in 1918. The only light in this never-ending tunnel came from a black pianist, Reg Duval, who taught him some ragtime techniques. Hoagie paid no attention to the preachings of the Ku Klux Klan, which was very powerful in Indiana at that time, and he could hear in black music an echo of his own wounds. By inhaling cement powder and wading through spilled blood, he saved enough money to resume his studies at Indiana University and to pull himself back up from despair. Hmm. This is where he was. And it was that background which caused him to become so obsessed with jazz and with what he saw as the richness of black culture, which he was actually identifying with himself. So hot jazz, bootleg booze became the new passion for people like Hoagie and for Bix Beiderbecke, of course. Hoagie's own account of Bix is fairly interesting. This is what Bix has to say about the very first time Hoagie has to say about the very first time he ever heard Bix play. For the first time, Hoagie would hear Bix's cornet, just four notes, he would remember. But he didn't blow them. He hit them like a mallet hits a chime. And his tone, his richness, yes, just four notes. He would confirm in 1979, some little thing, and I knew it was right. It was just that those few notes sounded like something I might have been waiting for, searching for my whole life, without even knowing they were what I was after. It was springtime in Indiana, a season smiling on the two young musicians, and Hoagie was stuck on his new friend. He of the funny little mouth, the sad eyes that popped a little as if in surprise when those notes showered from his horn. The air was thick and soft and pale purple. Grass was greener. The moon was yellower, as he would write many years later. They were young, and after the Wolverines concerts, they spent hours in Hoagie's room, taking a drink of whiskey that tastes like kerosene in your mouth and a blowtorch going down. Lying in front of the phonograph early in the morning, we were playing the Firebird music of Stravinsky while playing jazz at night. Well, Carmichael was writing at this time, and he wrote a song for the second recording session that the Wolverines had gone into, a song called Riverboat Shuffle. So let's hear this track written by Hoagie Carmichael for Bix and the Boys. Let's hear that track from the second recording session called Riverboat Shuffle. Thank you. another really early track from Whip Big Spider Bix Band called The Wolverines that recorded on May 6th, 1924. They had learned that song just 3 days before recording it. Hokey Carmichael taught it to them, and they had 3 days to learn it. Then they went into the studio and recorded. And again, great job recording it. The mix sounds really good,
yep.
Considering. Don't forget, this was at a time when recordings were acoustic. You played into a horn, and everything was a matter of how close or how far away you stood. And if you didn't get a good mix, you'd have to throw it out, which is really why they say probably maybe as much as 80% of the recordings that were made at this time were thrown out, just totally wasted. So definitely, credit goes to where it deserves there with them pulling that off. Meanwhile, that being said, I'd like to thank everybody for listening to the show, and I hope you can join us next week as we continue our look at Bix, Tram, and the Jazz Age. And we'll be doing that again next Friday at 5 o'clock. Now, if you're interested in this series and you want to hear some of the things that you might have missed and catch up with us, you can go to our website. We've got all of our shows available there at AmericanHitRadio.com or AmericanHitNetwork.com. The Friday shows, very simply, are on the right side at the top of the page. You can go through the whole thing. You can find our series on Louis Armstrong. You can hear this show again anytime you wish just by playing it on demand if you want to, or hear our earlier shows on Jelly Roll Morton, or our more contemporary series on Motown and on the pre-British invasion. There's a lot of stuff there, so you can check it out at AmericanHitRadio.com and AmericanHitNetwork.com. Meanwhile, our archive site, Shut Up and Listen, is sidetracked for the time being. If you go there, it'll take you to our homepage anyway. We're building a new one for ourselves, bigger and better things for the archive sites coming soon. So I want to thank you very much. And we're going to leave you now with one track. Earlier, we had played a track by the New Orleans Rhythm Kings called Tiger Rag, one of the jazz classics of all time. Well, Bix and the boys recorded a version of that themselves around June of 1924. So we're going to end with that track by the Wolverines. Here's their version of Tiger Rag. Heidi, thank you very much. Earl, great job.
Thank you.
And I hope you can all tune in again. Put a note on your dashboard to tune back in next Friday at 5. Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye.